Welcome, everybody. All right, welcome to the Development Engineering Advisory Board. I am Sherry Jones, from SWCA.
Seth Pauling with AKS Engineering.
Ryan Wilson with Wilson Architects.
Eric Galimo, SJ Engineering.
Dan Weisner, Songbird Homes.
Mike Odwin, McKay Sposito.
Megan Fletcher, Community Development. Michaela Rankin, Community Development.
Houston Aho, Aho Construction.
Justin Wood, Clark County Association of Realtors.
Brent Davis, Community Development.
Shannon Nashup, Development Engineering.
And online?
Jamie Housley, Jordan Remus.
Dave Howe, Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Teresa Hardy, Friends of Clark County, Sierra Club.
Naomi Patibanwa, Development Engineering.
I think we have a couple online that we haven't heard from. Brittany? Not sure. And then there's, is that everyone? Okay, that's everyone. As a reminder, DEEB is being recorded and the audio will be posted on the DEEB's website. All right, the first item we have is to review and adopt the minutes. Did everyone have a chance to review?
I have, Madam Chair, and I do have one correction to make. It's on the second page under the Council Work Session debrief, the third bullet item. It talks about the independent review, which we'll be talking about today. And it says independent review instead of an appeal. I don't think that that's what we discussed, that any independent review or review by DEEB would not be in lieu of an appeal. So I think that that's those four words instead of an appeal should just be stricken. Strike instead of an appeal. And just have independent review and leave it at that. Other than that, I would move for approval.
Any?
Second.
Okay, I was gonna say, was that a motion, Mike? Yes, okay. And then Jamie, you seconded?
Yes.
Awesome. All in favor?
Aye.
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 All right. Any opposed? Great. Thank you. So many papers today. Okay, where are we at? Megan.
Good afternoon, everybody. So I just want to make clear that when the agenda is typed up, a lot of times there is not agenda information online for council hearings or commission, so it is a little blank. I do have a work session that actually took place on the 6th for the Commission on Aging, Law and Justice, and then most of what we're seeing is on the Planning Commission. So April 17th, we have the 2023 comp update. It's a continuation from March 5th, and then on the 17th as well, Commission on Aging. There is public hearing scheduled for the 16th for the approval of the ordinance 2024-03-02. The 17th, again, Commission on Aging, and on the 23rd, the 2023 comp plan update, also a continuation from March 5th. Thank you.
Four 17 council work session. Did you mention that one? Or is that Planning Commission?
It's Planning Commission, but after reviewing, it looks like there's the population and housing for 17th.
That's probably a big one for us.
that was, and like I said, the agenda was just put online. So I was just checking that. So that is the 17th at 9 a.m., and that is a work session. And the first topic is population, housing, and employment allocation. And the second is Heritage Farms Sustainability Plan.
All right, any member announcements? No? Okay. I have something not necessarily related to D, but I wanted to share. I shared with a couple people on the elevator. SWCA is working on a toolbox program in our elementary schools. So we've done 5 elementary schools so far with about 550 students that are building toolboxes right at the school. But we have a couple of really big schools coming up that we're going to need a few adult volunteers at, and I know you guys are in the industry. So if you are interested in helping with that, we would love some hands. So let me know. I'll give you more info. Okay. So we are going to give updates on our 2024 work plan items, and we will kick off with Mike Odrin.
All right, I've handed out, I'll go ahead and hand out to the other members of the audience here as well. Is there a way to display it on the screen? No. No. Hot off the, literally hot off the presses. No. I had started it and then picked it up again today and revised it, and then our network went down, and so I wasn't even hardly able to get hard copies, let alone send it out. So anyway, for those D members that are online today, I'm going to go ahead and read through this pretty quickly, let you know. This is a kind of a draft review, or draft D review process that we were requested to provide based on our last meeting with the council, and I'm going to read through it. I'm a pretty fast reader, so if you want me to slow down, oh, Andrew, grab one of these two. Tell me to stop. We can take notes and whatever. Again, this is a first draft of this, and would be interested in everybody's input as far as what I've provided thus far. At the request of the Board of County Councilors, provided below is a draft framework for DEEB's review of project-specific issues, code interpretation questions, and other development-related matters. The DEEB bylaws state the advisory board shall review and comment as requested by the county manager, the BOCC, and or senior staff on project-specific development issues. The language in the bylaws is very important as we move forward. Based on the above, provided below is an outline of how DEEB can assist in providing guidance, insight, and opinion on development matters by consultants, developers, private citizens, or other non-county staff. As the DEEB is an advisory board, none of the decisions made by the DEEB can be binding. All final decisions rest with the community development director and or his or her designee. Based on the bylaws, a private petitioner, parenthetically, consultant, developer, private citizen, etc., requesting to have their issue heard by the DEEB must first request it of county staff. A petitioner cannot directly request of the DEEB to present their issue. Said request must come from county staff. Staff shall contact the DEEB's staff liaison to have it included on the DEEB's agenda. The petitioner is encouraged to provide as much background information as possible, as early as possible, regarding their particular issue. This can be in the form of plans, narratives, previous public email correspondence with county staff, etc. Once an issue has been brought to the DEEB for review, the DEEB will review it at their next scheduled meeting. Following a presentation by the petitioner, the DEEB shall discuss the merits of the issue and render an opinion via vote. Unless the opinion is unanimous, an opinion by the DEEB shall otherwise be based on the majority vote. Understanding that some development-related issues are not black and white, in instances where the opinion is not necessarily in favor of or not in favor of, the petitioner's position on a particular issue. Oh, Sorry, let me back up a little. In instances where the opinion is not necessarily in favor of or not in favor of the petitioner's position on a particular issue, the DEEB shall explain their position to the greatest extent practicable. An issue to be heard by the DEEB shall not substitute for any required code or codified review process. An issue to be heard by the DEEB shall take place prior to issuance of a staff report or decision. An issue heard by the DEEB may be included in a finding of fact in a staff report or decision. So that's kind of
Mike. Can you slow down real quick?
Speak up, Jamie.
On the timing issue. What if there's a deadline for? So I guess what I'm trying to say is like an applicant's going to have to waive certain timeframes if the matter kind of goes over the shot clock. Have we given that consideration as part of this?
No, that's good. That's why we're here today.
Yeah, the review timeline would have to pause for the deed review portion of it.
That's good. And what I'll do is I'll email this out loud to the members of DEEB tomorrow, either tonight or tomorrow, so that you all have it, and then you can respond back in kind with any comments that you might have as well, if there's anything more than what we talk about today. But no, that's a great one, Jamie. Thank you.
So other than just complying with the bylaws, is the point that they have to bring it to the staff first is that the staff makes a determination on whether it's the type of question DEEB can make a decision, or it's like within our purview?
There's nothing in the bylaws that allows the public to directly petition the board.
Okay.
Our board.
So I guess what I'm getting at is staff doing anything other than just that they're the first person that they bring it to? They're not like weeding out things that aren't necessarily within DEEB's scope?
I wouldn't know what staff is doing. But I do know that in instances where, in the past, for instance, where there have been disagreements between transportation related items, and Ollie encouraged them, in particular applicant to, hey, bring this to DEEB. Let them hear it, on the merits of what you're saying and see if they would agree with your position on this, kind of as a little bit of a, could we support something like that? It's only happened a few times, but I don't know what staff is doing right now. And I think that this would take some buy-in from staff. So this is one part of this. This is kind of the guideline. The other part of this would be getting the word out, that this is an avenue by which staff can advise an applicant if there is a question on a code interpretation or whatever, say, hey, you can bring it before the DEEB. I would support you bringing it before the DEEB, but I don't see anything in the bylaws that allow the general public or anybody else to bring something before us. And I think that that's maybe a little bit of a challenge.
I guess that's fine. I guess I was just wondering if the point is to allow staff, if somebody says, I'd like this to go before DEEB, could staff say no?
On the surface, yeah, it looks like it. I would hope that wouldn't be the case, but, and that's a good point that you make, Ryan, that first of all, staff has to know that that avenue is there. They have to then pass that along to, the general public, and then they would have to advocate for them to bring it to DEEB as well, instead of just not letting them know. So I don't know how we would get around something like that.
I mean, is there a component that it might actually be less staff time in some of these issues if they do just advocate for it to go to DEEB instead of internally spending time debating and discussing? I don't know, like staff process and stuff, but potentially.
Typically when an issue comes up, at least on the planning side, and if there isn't any clear and concise answer as found in the code, the Brain Trust gets together on a Monday. Is that about right?
It's Tuesday now.
Right. The Brain Trust gets together on a Tuesday and they review, you know, the merits of what it is that the applicant or consultant are trying to do. You know, that's kind of, and they're on an island. Bringing Deeb into even those discussions sometimes. And this is just for the public, that staff is always welcome to bring anything before Deeb to get our input before rendering a decision that might be a binding decision that might have, you know, a unintended consequences later on down the road. And I would encourage staff to maybe take advantage of that opportunity. And I know that sometimes there's time sensitivity to these. And if there is some time sensitivity, maybe there's an opportunity for Deeb to review some of these items from the staff side through email and not wait for our next meeting. But if we're going to be hearing something, you know, presented from the public, it might be a little bigger issue that isn't easily that there isn't an easy answer to it. There could be a couple different outcomes based on how you read the code or whatever.
First, good job on this. I think we did a good job of kind of explaining what we've done in the past. A few suggestions.
Absolutely.
One in the project title.
Yeah.
Like a little more specific. So if you pull this up, like the project specific review process, just so it's a little more specific.
Yes.
And then maybe like a purpose or like an intent statement that kind of says when this is used. So we go just right into the bylaws and then the procedures. But kind of example of like, when should this really be used? When is it appropriate? I mean, what I think is kind of maybe some examples, issues on development during a land use application or engineering plan review, or, you know, any road modification things. Those are some examples of how, you know, what types of issues we may hear. And I think it's going to really be more of a last resort. This is when an applicant and staff are kind of at a stalemate.
Yep.
This isn't something, we don't want to hear a lot of these, really.
Right.
I mean, it should be the applicant and staff working through issues. And I'd say that's why we don't hear too many.
Right.
99, you know, at least 99% of the time, if not more, it's worked out from staff. So this is a last resort. Mm-hmm. And then one of the bottom bullets, it said an issue to be heard by Deeb shall take place prior to issuance of a staff report and decision. I would say if applicable, because most of the things we are hearing are during final engineering review. There is no staff report or decision. This could be interpreted as we only hear things before a decision or as a land use decision. So I would say,
and that makes sense in from a development engineering standpoint. But for a road modification item or something like that, it would be before the decision would be rendered.
For engineering issues, there's no staff report.
That's true.
So we want to make sure it's clear that we can hear things
I would
that don't
say
require
as
staff
applicable.
Reports. Yeah, as
applicable. Yep. Okay, great. And again, I'll send this all out. I'll based on our discussion today, I'll gussy this up, send it back out, and then you know, we can get some other comments on this as well.
Just one more comment from I think we'll probably want to make sure that we have like a recusal for conflict of interest if it's your project.
Okay.
Hey, did we talk some about the actual procedure internally here and being able to review it in a timely manner?
We have not. This is the first time we've really...
Our last meeting, we talked a little bit about, is this something that we can do via email, or does it have to wait for our meeting here?
So I do have in here that it would be heard at our next meeting. However, and then that comes in the waiver of any required jurisdictional timelines. I think it could be brought to us via email, and we can maybe then make a decision as to whether or not we need to actually be together to review it, discuss it, or whether or not we can look at it and go, nah, this person doesn't know what they're talking about, or wow, this is something that has never come up before and warrants, you know, a little more discussion, or maybe it is a clean cut decision that can be made. But I don't see any reason that can't be the case, and maybe I'll add something in there to be heard at their next meeting or in certain circumstances via email. Or something like that. Anything else? Oh, here, April, let me get you one.
Oh, I have it. I have a question about it.
Sure.
The issue to be heard by DEEB shall take place prior to issuance of staff report and decision.
As applicable.
Well, the only thing I'm thinking about that is there has to be, because that would extend the timeline.
That was the first thing we talked about.
Okay,
before you came
all right,
in.
Sorry.
Yeah, that we would want to add a section that, you know, the applicant may need to waive their review timelines. Yep.
I think it wouldn't be like a waiver, but maybe a tolling.
Yeah, I just wrote that down or placed the project on hold.
I think other jurisdictions, I've talked to King County and Kitsap, they'll have a waiver system for something not like this, because nobody else has DEEB, but when a review has to go longer, they'll have to ask for a waiver.
Right, a waiver most likely from the 120-day state codified review process, yep. All right, well, if there isn't anything else from anybody else, I'll go ahead and make these changes and send it out, and we'll take it up at the next meeting and see if that's something we can, I don't know how exactly this gets out to the public, to staff. Maybe that's something we can all maybe noodle on over the next month and then pick it up next month.
Okay.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Mike. That was great. Really thorough. Okay, so next up is me to talk about condos. So where condos is at, thank you, Justin. He sent me something right before the meeting, but I haven't had a chance to look at it. So I did meet with a lobbyist that is familiar with kind of condo legislation in the state of Washington, and there are a lot of components that are challenging when it comes to condos. And so what he asked of me is to come to this room and find out what specific pieces of the condo legislation are the biggest challenges in Clark County, so that we can be more targeted in our discussion with legislators, and also bringing in, I know council had asked if we could rally their lobbyists to help support these efforts. So before we can rally, we need really specific things that we want to focus on. And so I don't know if the room has that or we need to ask around.
So I reached out after you and I talked, I reached out to the executive director of AIA Washington and try to get my own memory going about what the architects have done on condos over the years. On our side, the issue is the implied warranties that condos have. And in 2019, there was House Bill 1576, which is a bill that the architects were really behind. And I think that one, I don't know all the details, but I think it tried to address the implied warranty issue. It did not pass. There was another one that was ESB 5334 that had some like modified language, which we were not super. It was better than what it is now, but it didn't go as far as we were wanting it to. But it also did not pass. So.
What year did you say the House Bill 1576 was?
2019.
Yeah. I think there was a bill that passed that limited the number, and it had a different process for condos under a certain number. I don't know what that is right offhand, but I remember seeing that bill come across my desk at some point. And then the other piece, too, is WCAIA, when that went through, kind of treats HOAs like condo associations. Mm-hmm. And it almost has the same issues where the stuff that's broken about condos, instead of fixing that, we move those now to subdivisions. I don't know if you guys have had these, but it seems like the same attorneys that sue all the condos are getting lined up to sue pretty much any developer who does a site. Because I got a few notices, and the biggest one I always see is the yards are soggy. So we have to deal with that. Well, they have to be soggy. That's a state code now. We have to use amended soil. You have to be able to put a probe in, and it has to go pretty much unresisted for 12 inches. So it is going to be soggy if you amend the soil and you do it right. But we're getting named in lawsuits basically, it's the same thing on every single one. They just take a list and they're like, here's the issues, and they're looking for a quick settlement. And they're going after the insurance money. And because of that, it makes them, it just passes that cost down to the end consumer. And most of them are frivolous. So it's just the same, you know, list of things.
Insurance liability.
Yep. And then the insurance company's probably like, oh, you know what, what's it worth to litigate versus settle? And you know, they settle and they use those funds to go after more. So that's really the issue. How do you fix that?
Is the time frames on that one, like, it's part of the issue I know we've always had with condos is it's like a 10-year, the implied warranty is a 10-year period. Well, in 10 years, stuff's going to wear out and break down. And, you know, even if it's not necessarily a design flaw, it's just, you know, whatever reached the end of its useful life. But, you know, that if you do a condo project, there's this implied sense that you've warranted everything for 10 years, which that's what makes them difficult to do. I don't know if that time frame is the same on that, but.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure this is something that we're not going to solve in this room. And it's gone towards the state legislature for quite a few years, and they've tried to fix it. And I think they've tried to work on the period, requiring a, instead of like court process, like a mitigation or something, or mediation, I think is what they were recommending. And I'm not sure where all that stuff is, but that's the issue. And there's more than just that for condos though right now. And a lot of it is, this is more on the financial side. Most of the time when you're building apartment buildings or condo buildings, you're not breaking even right away. You're upside down. Time fixes it. So you have to rent it out for a certain number of years. You have to have that income, and the building has to appreciate, and rents have to go up before that building was even worth doing. And that wasn't always the case, but in the current environment, with rates the way they are, with labor costs, with all the other, you know, building costs, that's what we're seeing with our clients is you can do a condo if you want it. It's not financially feasible. You have to do apartments unless there's some kind of subsidies or tax breaks or something.
Okay, and that was the piece that, because it's a state, it really is a state issue, but if there are things within that we can incentivize, I think was what they wanted to see in Clark County. So if we can identify what those specific tangible things are, and then what can we do in our county to combat that. I don't think there's an easy answer, but this is helpful to some past legislation that we can dive into maybe a little bit, because it sounds like there's some solutions built in. So even if the state didn't adopt those solutions, I mean, maybe Clark County can look at some practices from that.
We can certainly encourage the county has their own lobbyist. You know, if they're looking at condos as a way to increase homeownership, then maybe they can encourage, you know, push their lobbyists to work on liability reform.
And the lobbyists echoed what both of you have said, that there's been groups for years that have been trying to fight it. The problem is it's, you know, one group over here fights it this year, and then 2 years later it's this group over here. And so he agreed that we really have to rally together. And and his opinion was, Southwest Washington is already on the map from a legislative perspective. This would really put Southwest Washington on the map if we were able to reach, you know, get the jurisdictions together and really push for this. That could make a big impact. So I will do some more digging on this, and I'll pull together some resources of people who build condos and have worked on legislation, and come back with an update.
And I would add that it's a whole bunch of financial stuff. You know, the HOAs, actually a condo association, you can't self-run them anymore with the new rules. I mean, it becomes very difficult because you have lawyers come after you, and you also have these reserve studies that are mandated now. And you know, we used to be able to do a bunch of that stuff ourselves and put it in the budget, but now you cannot go through that process because of all the wording in the law, so you just can't do it. And like we've talked about, the HOAs getting very, very similar to that too. I mean, we used to run all of our HOAs were self-run, and we tried to make it very simple, you know, try and break out to where on the townhouses, all the individual houses maintain their own maintenance on the exterior, And there were just some very common elements like stormwater, but anymore that becomes very difficult to do. So,
Terry.
Yeah, sorry, my service is not great, so I apologize if it's not coming through well, but wanted to just quickly say another point is property taxes and how those could be, if you're hitting a certain affordability index with pricing, that you know, we could look at something similar to what's done with multifamily with apartments in Vancouver that could help on the affordability side. So that also would help, I think, in promoting condo construction in Clark County.
Jamie, did you have something to add, or you just joined us on video?
I'm just parked.
Okay. This gives me a good starting place for some specific things to look into. Thank you. Next up, we have livability, parks.
I included in the packet kind of where we left off with the Parks Board, and it looks like we did most of the work, and well, we met for about a year, but then we kind of met with the council and had recommendations in April of 2019. It was kind of on the list to go to the next time the parks went, when the park plan was redone, we were going to incorporate some of these into the revised park plan. I don't know what that schedule is. There's been a lot of things that happened since then. Kind of COVID kind of, I think, kind of shut down that effort for now. But what I can do is I can reach out to the Parks Board. And I'm not sure who runs the Parks Board now or who's the chair. It's probably turned over a few times since then. Okay, if you can find out, that'd be great. We can reach out to them, maybe forward the information. And also, I think there's a new director of the Parks Department. I'm not sure who the staff person is for Parks now, but that's probably another contact we need to kind of touch base with. But the recommendations are in here. Not to reiterate them, but there's a few that were things like counting public areas that are actually used as parks but not in the plan, things like school playgrounds that have some use when the kids are out. There's a lot of parks that are not counted towards the inventory, like larger regional, like Louisville Park, Vancouver Lake Park. Some of those parks like that are just not included. In other jurisdictions that have the same ratio, they are included. So they include other parks. We just kind of include certain parks. So we talked about private parks, open space greenways, you know, trails being included as well, and also maybe some type of a credit system. If you're going to do things on your site, you can credit towards your park impact fees. So those are kind of some of the recommendations. They're all in your packet. And I think the next step is really kind of reaching out and trying to get this restarted. So
I remember one of the last discussions that we had here at Deeb regarding this was that in order to quantify, for instance, pocket parks in any one particular development, for even considering PIF credits, they need to meet a certain level of development, which apparently the Parks Department does not have. I know that on a project that I worked on in Camas, they were gonna have a neighborhood park in there, and they were gonna get PIF credits as a result of it, but it had to meet a certain level. And so there was there's an actual document in the city of Camas that says a neighborhood park of this size has these elements in it. These are required elements. These are, you know, they have at least three of these other nine elements in there. And that if you meet all of those and you get your design approved by city engineering and the Parks Department, then you are then eligible for PIF credits. The quantification of those credits, I don't know how they do it, so it might be worth it once we get a little bit further down the road to ask those questions. But I think that that's where we left it was, I think I remember saying something along the lines of, well, why don't you guys put together a guide so that there are some set standards by which these parks, pocket parks, whatever it is, can be built by so that they meet the metric by which it can be counted towards meeting the inventory. And therefore, credits can be applied. So that's one item. The second one that I've always had, you know, kind of difficulty getting my arms around was how do we quantify the trails aspect of this? If we're going to be doing, you know, a lot of developments, plan unit developments have some sort of trail system. They have, you know, maybe some unbuildable areas. You know, they can certainly do a pathway through wetland buffers and habitat areas. How does that then get quantified as far as a PIP credit calculation? And so I think that if we can get the Parks Board on board with this, get council on board with this, I don't know as if our work's quite done yet, because then we have to quantify all this so that there's a, you know, a set calculation, so that if somebody comes in with a 20-acre development and they want to do X acres in park and it has to be to a certain level, and all of that's been met, then what is their credit? What exactly is that number? And so it might mean reaching out to, and like I've always said, stealing shamelessly from other jurisdictions, the best stuff from other jurisdictions, reaching out to City of Camas to see what their program is and using that as a baseline.
So, yeah, another thing that we were, the reason we looked at this in the first place was linked to the park impact fee increase, which already went through. So it's one of those things where it probably became not as urgent because when it got put on hold, other things happened. The parks did increase the fees, and I think they went up something like, if I remember right, it was like 250 to like 300%. But they hadn't raised them in a long time. So some of the recommendations that we had on here could kind of roll that back. And, you know, when they look at their goals, if we're counting areas, more areas in it, and their need is less, and their capital facility plan can go down, they should be able to look back and you know, reduce.
I think that's where we actually started.
That's kind of what we wanted. And then some of the other things, and an option to get credits, so to credit against those increased fees. So that was part of them passing that bill was, yeah, we'll pass it right now, but let's kind of look at implementing some of these. There's probably not as much incentive for the parks now to do this
because they've already got it in place. They're not going to roll it back now. I think we really got to push the PIP credit part of it.
So just reality of it. That's probably we're going to. It may not be as I don't know. There's just not as much incentive for them to go back and look at it now.
Right.
Battleground did it or has done this for quite some time. We were one of the first ones that did it, and this just we just basically gave them the invoice for what it cost us. And then we did trail a basketball court and park structure and
perfect.
Stuff, so
that's the easy way.
Yeah.
All right. And
there was a max amount that we can go to.
Okay, max amount. So was that a credit towards the entire development or on a per lot basis, or was it up to the developer?
It was a total amount of the credit that was available. So it was just, here's your credit, you put them in account, and then you can use them on your project, or we actually sold some. We actually had excess.
Oh, okay. Excellent. Thank you.
So I've done quite a number of these in Eastern Washington where it's much easier to do. So there's standard is typically the developer will come up with a plan, we'll submit it to staff. Sometimes staff just makes a call on what they want, and then other times staff reviews it slightly and then sends it to Parks Board to get kind of their general comments. For modifications. Most of the jurisdictions on the east side make the accounting a little simpler where they just they have a ratio for what you're putting in and then they just exempt lots so you're not, you know, tracking PIF credits back and forth, which makes it quite a bit simpler rather than saying here's $750,000 worth of PIF credits, and you're going to have to pay this amount on this amount of lots. They'll just exempt either the entire phase, the entire plat, and then credits would come in if there was a surplus amount. And like Pasco for years had a standard park size. Granted, the areas of land we get over there are a lot larger, but they wanted 5-acre parks. They didn't want anything larger than 5-acre. 5-acre was their standard. They just wanted 5 acres dedicated. They didn't even want it improved. And then they went through their own public process and got their 5 acres in. So like we did a 600 lot plat in Pasco years ago, Linda LaVisa. They wanted 5 acres. They just subtracted whatever that 5 acres of dedication would have cost off of our PIF fee. So if the PIF fee was, say, $1,200, by the time they got done with our dedication and we did all the frontage around it, each lot was assessed like $125 with the PIF fee. So that's the way they've done it. West Richland, when we did our last one, they just exempted every lot in the entirety of the development. And that had a mix of privately owned trails and public park that was improved and dedicated. With the private trails, they counted them towards their public open space and trail calculation by requiring a dedication of a public access easement over them. So all the trails are maintained by the HOA and owned by the HOA.
Sorry about that. Maintenance of these facilities, whether it be dedicated to the parks or whether it remain with the HOA and they maintain it. And what you're saying here, Houston, is that the parks were dedicated, the trails were not, but then there's a trail easement over it.
Yeah, so there's a kind of a split of maintenance requirement All right. and ownership. So most of the jurisdictions over there are pretty flexible. It works out pretty well for the most part. And then it's always up to the developer to determine if they want to put the park in or if they don't want to put the park in. Obviously, everybody's usually encouraged to put the park in, but it just comes down to an economic number and what can realistically be put in. You know, parks in small plats aren't going to work because you don't want a 3,000 square foot park. It's not going to fit in. But when you start getting much larger tracts of land, the parks become a little easier and trails become easier to put in there and tie in. And that may be one of the issues you're having in Clark County right now is everything's so parcelized. Parks are kind of hard to get into these neighborhoods. And there's no real incentive to put a park in. I tried to put a 5-acre park here in a PUD with the county. It's probably 7-8 years ago now. And they just wouldn't take it. They said, well, we're going to put the park in. You're going to put the park in. We can try to get it from the HOA for maintenance, but we still want our park fees. So it's a double dip. So I have no one, I still put parks in the neighborhoods, mm-hmm. but it's just really disheartening that there wasn't that level of give and take, I guess.
Sure.
Lack of words for that. Apologize. But that's just I could go on forever, so I'll be quiet now, but that's just a general recap of what
No, that's great information. Thank you, Houston. We might, lean on you moving forward with this to provide a little more insight as far as your experiences are concerned with other jurisdictions.
Yeah, I was just going to ask if the jurisdictions you're doing that with, do they have a written policy or procedures or code? If you can pass that along, maybe it's something we can work with. So,
yeah, I'm not sure
how written it is. Let us know what the jurisdictions are. We know how to research stuff like that. And the more information that we have when we present this back to the Parks Board, the easier it is for them.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
Okay, I think that's all for that, unless someone else has questions on the Parks thing.
Awesome, thank you. All right, moving on to permitting. Ryan.
Okay, I've been working on this one on the building side, and Andrew's been working on more on the land use and civil side. I've been asking people in my office and some of my other colleagues and other firms
just, you know, what about the permitting process might be streamlined to help permits go a little bit faster. Pretty much the one that always comes up is just continued improvements on the e-plan system, trying to reduce the number of steps it takes to get through that process. There's kind of an inordinately large number of steps that you kind of have to do on submittals at the moment. So trying to reduce that would help. A couple other things that have come up right now for building permits, the county requires separate permits for building, mechanical, electrical, and plumbing permits. A lot of other jurisdictions have gone to a single combined permit for building permits, since typically all that stuff gets submitted. Especially for new construction projects, we almost always have mechanical, electrical, and full plumbing design included in the building permit submittal, especially because energy code requirements dictate it. A single combined permit that includes all of those trade permits just helps keep things a little bit simpler. You don't have as many permit numbers. Even helps the guys in the field that when they're calling inspections, they're not calling on multiple different permit numbers. One other one is the city of Vancouver now has an early start program for you. It's really only useful on very easy TIs, so typically small tenant improvements that aren't overly complicated. The early start permit allows them to do framing and just not cover, so they can get a lot of that initial framing done while the project is still in review. The other comment, and I don't know if there's really much that can be done about this at the moment, but the biggest complaint in terms of just what seems to be taking so long on building permit timelines right now is that the county is relying on third-party reviewers, especially for structural reviews, and they are just not turning stuff around very quickly. It seems, you know, we'll get all the way through everything else and weeks will go by while we're waiting for the structural review to come back. So that seems to be the biggest source of frustration with people at the moment is just how long those non-county reviewers are taking.
Ryan, has the county typically had in-house structural review in the past?
They have in the past, yeah.
April has a question too.
Yeah.
So before we had Ravi, Ravi would do our structural plan review.
Yeah.
And so we opened that up for another structural engineer and didn't get any applications. It's not the third party's fault. We had a couple of contract issues. So we have triple the amount of structural reviews that we had last year, and we weren't really expecting that. So the contracts that we had were tiny, and we ran out of money. And so then we had to update those contracts, and then we ran out again. So then we just did an RFP, and it won't happen anymore. And then I hear the opposite about plumbing and mechanical, where when they come in for building permit, they'll tell me they don't know who is going to do their plumbing yet. And so that's why they like to have it separate, because then the plumber can come in. So I hear the exact opposite. It's interesting. I mean, I'll look into it. I'm not going to.
That's that whole design build deferred submittal deal.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to be able to. Yeah, you don't always know all the contractors at the time you submit. So there needs to be a way to like add the contractor numbers either at the time you pick up the permit or something like that, rather than at the time you submit.
So what would you prefer? What would be the best way as far as the building permit was concerned? Would you rather have separate MEPs and building, or you want
one permit?
Yeah. Now then, how do you dovetail that with deferred submittals and design build?
Well, I mean, deferred submittals are kind of going away in general, partly because energy code requirements are, you know, you have to do, so many decisions have to be made early in the design process nowadays. It's just getting harder and harder to, you know, say, all right, you know, some future mechanical engineer is going to figure this out. You know, you kind of need them involved right at the very beginning. You know, in theory, there could be, once again, very small or simple TIs where you could push that off, but I don't know. I guess with the City of Vancouver, you can request a building-only permit, and then the mechanical and electrical could be separate, but the standard is a combined permit.
So a building permit that takes care of everything, structural, yeah. MEP, foundation.
Yeah. And I'd say 98% of the projects we do, we have all of that at the time we submit. So it's kind of nice not to have to.
But what about
fill out three separate applications?
What about those times when you want to get a, say, well, the building's not quite done yet, but we'd really like to get our foundation permit separate so that we can get the contractor rolling. And we're going to have, and we really don't know who's going to be doing the MEP. I mean, and I know that this is very complicated, and I only know enough about it to ask the question, but not know all the answers. I just want to make sure that what we're indicating to staff is what the most common situation is, but that there's always a request for the off option too. Meaning, can we do a building permit for everything? Oh, and by the way, in these very unique situations, can we also do this but pull out plumbing? You know, something like that. And where I'm going with this is that may have been what led the county to where they are today. Did the county used to just have one building permit where everything was included?
Well, so like the city's application, when you're filling it out, it's got are you requesting a deferred submittal? And if so, you have to check which ones you're requesting.
Okay.
And the fee goes up if you're requesting, they charge higher fees if you're requesting a deferred submittal.
Okay.
So the cheapest is to submit everything up front and get one permit. In the case, so foundation only permits, with those, the way those, the ones we've done in the past, and Clark County does issue foundation only permits as well.
Mm-hmm.
What typically happens with those is once you've gone through first review, you can request a foundation only permit. But that's sort of like an early start. You know, you're requesting, you know, something where
it's already part of the original building,
flat plumbing and then form everything, but you can't pour or something, or you can pour everything up to pouring concrete, but it's still, it's something that they do prior to the full permit being issued.
Okay.
So,
right.
But I mean, even then you'd have to, like I said, you'd have to have plumbing pretty much reviewed, because all of the subslab plumbing would have to have been reviewed and approved. The structural, you'd have to at least be far enough along that the structural's confident in it. And then the same with life safety on the architectural side. You'd at least have to have gone through first review architectural to be confident that, you know, you're not going to have to be moving a bunch of walls around. So, you know, people always request those foundation only permits, and I'm like, it saves you a couple of weeks. But that's about it.
Kind of like early grading permits.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Anything else on that one, or I'll pass it on to Andrew for land use and civil.
Sure. Thanks, Mike. So I visited a little bit with our in-house permit specialist on kind of just looking at the project docs and LMS submittal and review processes, trying to brainstorm issues there or challenges or things that we might be able to do better. And one of the things she did say is that it's come a long way since when we started the electronic review processes. We worked through a lot of kinks as far as initially on the engineering plan review, we weren't like, we wouldn't get markups on the plan sheets, we would just get comments and we'd know that it was a comment on sheet two, but not specifically where on the sheet that occurred. That's been fixed, and there's other pieces that have been going pretty well, I think, in terms of response time on calculating fees and being able to get things into the system. Frankly, the county's doing a little better than the city on a lot of that stuff, which is which is good. But a few of the ideas or issues that my permit person was mentioning. One thing in project docs, when you submit something to the staff, you guys have built in at least goals of timelines, if not in some cases legislative requirements. It would be nice, and the city's done this on their end, if the applicant could view sort of the deadline or gold timeline for when staff is going to complete a task after it's been assigned to them. I think that'd be beneficial both certainly to the applicant, but also to the county to an extent in terms of us no longer having to be continuously nagging you guys. If we have an expectation of when something's supposed to be done, then we do our best to stay off your backs and not just hammer you guys with emails.
Our clients love that, by the way, when we can pull up at the city and say, oh, they have 3 more days in which to issue their comments, and then we can always see what comments have already been issued ahead of time, before they release the plans back to us. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's great. And that, I don't know on your side of the system what that looks like, if it's simply a box that needs checked, or, you know, so none of these are necessarily me pretending to know how easy or complicated these are, but that was one comment. We do have some questions or concerns about the as-built end of the process, particularly why we're still submitting Mylar copies of as-built drawings. With the continuing evolution nationwide, frankly, of electronic plan review, we're actually finding that it's harder to get Mylar to actually print. I mean, we talked to J2 at this point, you know, it's eight bucks a sheet for us to print Mylars. Everything else is electronic. It's kind of hard to understand why we haven't moved to a point that electronic as-built submittal is going on. We had a project the other day. It was $1,000 of copies for our client to submit final as-built.
I have an answer to that one. We want to. We want to go digital. DNR is, because I also think there's some time savings there. DNR is not allowing it at this time.
Interesting.
Who's what, DNR?
DNR. I don't know why we have
Department of Natural Resources?
Yes. I don't know why we, I don't understand why we have
somebody from DNR up there?
I don't know.
Is there any reason why that's Clark County specific? Because in Eastern Washington, they got rid of Mylars quite some time ago.
Because we were asking about that and wanting to do it digitally and not have Mylar anymore, and that's what we were told.
Is the city still doing, are they to all digital Mylar or all digital as-built? Do you know? I would be curious about what other jurisdictions are doing around here. And
I'm actually not. I'm not 100% positive.
I'll check into it too, because if it's Eastern Washington, that's the same state agency would have to be.
Yeah, I mean, they still require paper copies, but they're not actually the physical Mylars, what you're talking about, correct? The one that's real fun to get your notary stamp on, right, and your Sharpie, and you got to use a special ink.
Yeah.
Right. So I know the biggest holdout we had in Eastern Washington was Grant County, but my understanding is Grant County even relaxed on that this year.
I'll check again, but when we were talking about the parcel number, you know, and the whole discussion we've had about getting parcel numbers early, I thought that going digital instead of having paper copies send in, I thought that that would actually save you the same amount of time and should be easier, and I was told no. But I'll check again. I'll make sure that no other jurisdiction is doing it that way.
Okay. Another thing, and I think Ryan actually brought this up when he and I sat down for a few minutes a few weeks ago, talking through this a little bit. One thing that feels pretty inefficient is sort of the non-automation, I guess, of when we upload something to LMS or to or to project docs, then we need to send an email to the correct email address that says, okay, we uploaded something, and wait for an email back.
Or we paid a fee.
Correct. Or to get a fee, same. And so every step of the process, we do something, then we got to tell people we did it, even though we've done it in an electronic system that's supposed to make things simpler. And if somebody missed sending that email, that, or on the county side somehow it gets missed, and I'm not saying that it does get missed on receipt, but that project can just sit in limbo for an undefined segment of time.
I've been a victim of that. It was my own fault.
Yep.
Absolutely my own fault.
Yep.
I forgot to send the email.
We've done.
I'm like, what's going on?
I had sent one to the wrong email address. Yeah.
I know why it happens. It's because my systems are not integrated. So
yeah.
Project Docs is not integrated with LMS. If it were, there would be more notifications both to you and to us.
Yeah.
And
I mean, we've worked through that internally as a company that has enough employees that we have a person that just deals with permits and you know, people that do things repeatedly in Clark County figure out pretty quick after having that happen to them once or twice or getting fired by a client or whatever it may be for a ball being dropped. They figure that out, but somebody coming from out of town, and that's part of the context of this conversation, is that not everybody does a whole bunch of work in Clark County. And so I understand there's reasons on your end, brainstorming, I guess, potential solutions. And I don't know if this is realistic, but could there be a staff person that once a week, even, you know, Friday at 3 o'clock on their calendar, they go out and see if there's just stuff that's just sitting out there that nothing's happened, right? Just trying to think about how to avoid that kind of issue for people that aren't really familiar with every step that's got to go on in the process. If the computer side of the equation doesn't allow for those kind of issues to be avoided, I don't know if there's a realistic, practical way that a staff person could be assigned to have a 5-minute, you know, once a week check to try to avoid that. But it is kind of, it's a challenge. And like Mike said, I mean, we've been guilty of it. He's been guilty of it. And,
yep. Shannon, is that something you'd like to do? Just kidding.
Yeah, that's, and when I was talking with our permitting person, I mean, she specifically mentioned just how good of a job you do to
try to help avoid that.
So, cool. I mean, we appreciate that, just trying to think through it. So,
I can speak for LMS. My teams don't really work in Project Docs except as reviewers, but that is one of the limitations of LMS, is that it does not allow automation of notification of those things. I've been able to address it for Wetland and Habitat with some of the reporting tools and creating a dashboard that staff can monitor for payments that have been made and also documents that have been submitted. The challenge for staff trying to monitor is you don't know what to monitor, right? Which cases do you go in and look at?
Gotcha.
Because the system doesn't create a log of those activities except for at the case level or the job level. So that's challenging. But I can certainly look into whether some of the reports I've created for Wetland and Habitat can be modified for some of the other programs, at least on the fee side.
Sure.
You know, mm-hmm. where you're submitting documents for Project Docs, well, I wouldn't be able to address that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, appreciate just brainstorming, like I said, to try to think about how to do things better. The last thing that we talked about internally was sort of the home stretch, I guess I'll say, of the engineering approval process seems to be incredibly inefficient. So typically, I would say our projects go through two engineering review cycles on the county's end. Typically at that point, we may have one, two, three lingering comments that for whatever reason are not completely 100% satisfying the staff level review engineer. We clean those up. We'll get clearance to submit, air quotes, final engineering plans. We've got to rename every file to put a final in front of it. And so we're at third review at this point, typically. And then that's the first time that it goes to the supervising engineer on the county side. And I would say it's more common than uncommon that we then receive some new comment from the approving engineer on the county's end that gets kicked back to us. And so now we've had basically a request for plans for approval that we've renamed to all the files, and we've got new comments coming back on third review that could have most certainly happened on second review if that review engineer was involved earlier in the process. We're incredibly careful to provide complete responses and address the review comments we receive on the first review. Typically the second review comments we get are something that's, I'll say, new or that's in response to our revisions. And now we're making reviews to what we thought were the final plans or revisions. We're resubmitting again another set that's called final. We're waiting 2 weeks for signatures, hopefully, that might come. And so that back end of the process, I mean, you're adding 4 to 6 weeks when you thought you were at approval. You're on a $2 million loan at 10% interest, $30,000 in interest, just over things beyond the point where you thought you were ready for approval. So, sorry. Yeah, right. Just playing some math and trying to keep the decimals easy. So I don't know if there's something that can be done there. It feels to me like the supervising review engineer gets brought into the process later than they should be. It's expensive. That's expensive land holding costs for the developer. And that happens in August, and now it's October, and now you're building in the rain again. And so forget about the interest costs, the construction costs just blossomed. So, that's just another one that feels like seems like it's incredibly tough to get over that last literally one half of 1% of the project to get to the finish line. So,
I mean, that one we're figuring out right now. Jennifer was, so you just didn't know it before, but Jennifer was in there and not reviewing it until the last person did. So that time was in there, you just didn't know it because she was doing it right after. And that's not how it is anymore, because Steve now signs for that or Ken for Platt. And so Steve is supposed to be looking at the done deal. And then if he finds something, he has to say something.
Sure.
So
yeah.
I get it. I don't know how else to do it, but I'll look at it. I mean, it's probably a lot, but I just think that you stall the time. You see the time now where you didn't see it before, because the same time is happening. Just Jennifer was seeing it before it got sent. And that's not how it is, because Steve is the signing engineer for those, and he should be seeing a more final product than what Jennifer was seeing.
Got it. And I apologize.
But I'll, I don't mind looking at it and seeing what we can do.
Yeah, yeah. And I apologize, I'm not sure who Steve is, actually.
Steve Gallup. So okay. Steve Gallup is signing our construction plans, and then Ken okay. is where Jennifer was. So Jennifer had signing authority before. Now Steve yeah. Gallup signs them. And okay. then, of course, Ken now signs the plats instead of what Jennifer was doing for that, too.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. Okay. Yeah, so I guess those are the few kind of comments that I got internally. I didn't reach out to other consultants on this at this point, but yeah.
I think that that's really the only thing that I've heard. You know, I brought up the final engineering end of the line, final signing last month. It sounds like you guys are having the same kind of issues that we had. Otherwise, from land development side, community development, I think it's, you know, it's about as good as it's getting. You know, we're used to it. We've done a lot of work on behalf of Deeb and some of the other consultants over the years that have, you know, kind of eked out a lot of the waste. There's a lot of more understanding. There's a lot more surety in submitting, particularly, you know, the fully complete has always been a hurdle to get over. Those sophisticated consultants know what to do now. You're going to get the architect that doesn't think that they should have to address something because they know better than they do. You accept it, of course, because you know what's going on. But you're always going to have that. But those of us around, you know, again, I would still encourage fully complete review. If there's just a couple of items, just email us. Don't send out a non-fully complete review thing. That we can turn those things around in a day or two. And otherwise the reviews are going. I think the early issues, that's been really good. We might have to put the application on hold for a little bit to address some of those, but that's been especially in dealing with some of the new code interpretations and working through that, it's worked out. And we're getting to a staff report and decision with a draft, quick turnaround on that. It's been good. So I think there's been a lot of improvements there. And I would not go back to the way it was. I would continue moving forward. So I do want to commend staff for a lot of the work that we've done over the past decade as far as the development review process is concerned.
And to piggyback on the fully complete part of it, we've had some cases where, you know, all the checklist items are on the plans, but because there's so much information, it starts to get buried. And so sometimes that stuff is just being missed on the county's review. But the timeline has been pushed far enough where they have to issue either fully complete or not fully complete. And it's stuff that, you know, we can just respond to that day or even the next day.
Yep.
And, you know, if those items are coming just a few days earlier, we can avoid that second turnaround of a two-week additional fully complete review. So in the past, I know Angie used to be really good about, you know, allowing that. And that was part of the reason why there was the two-week, special review for some of those who had gone through kind of that fully complete training.
Yeah, that I don't think that's the case anymore. Right. I know, Brent, you were talking about maybe trying to bring that back, but that wasn't.
So the planning techs are telling me that they're ready to go with 14 days.
Okay.
May 1st. So that's, we're going to start trying to do that.
Provided it's counter-complete upon submittal, right?
Right.
Okay. Good.
Yep. You know, and there may be cases that get kicked to 21 days because of complexity.
That's fine. If it goes to 17 days, just don't have them waste the time filling out the non-FC letter. That's time that they don't need to spend. Send us an email.
Yeah.
Seriously, just send us an email.
I've also had some good cases of where development engineering has just called and asked for clarification on something that they didn't understand, and it's been really helpful. You know, a couple of minutes on the phone can prevent another round of review, you know, and that's great. So we're happy to talk and discuss those items.
Yeah. I've had the same on the planning side as well. And Madam Chair, I might suggest we defer the next agenda item for our next meeting.
I agree. Because I would, this has been great discussion. So what I would like to do, so Jamie, if that's okay with you, because we're kind of out of time, we'll move that to our next meeting, your topic.
Yeah.
But I'd like to go back to the topics we did discuss today and see if there's any action items for either D members or staff so that we know it should be included on next month's agenda as well.
Madam Chair, I do have action items. As I mentioned before, I will incorporate the staff, D members' comments into the document there and then send out an updated document. I'll also send that to staff. So that they have a chance to review the updated information. I would also encourage staff to also chime in on anything like that as well, if they have any thoughts as far as the process is concerned. So I'll try to get that done sooner than later so that we're not right at the last minute trying to scramble to get that done.
Awesome. And then condos, I will do a bunch of digging and figure out kind of what some of the solutions are and then bring those for discussion as well.
On the parks, I just need to get contact information for the staff person now to talk to about that, and then also who's the parks board chair.
I'm hoping Houston can forward some of those jurisdictions that he's been working in so that we can start that researching some of their PIP credit options.
Yeah, I'll definitely look through my notes. I know there's developer agreements in a number of them, but I'll see what they had given me for procedure, and that's the biggest issue I see in Clark County. There's no procedure that
right.
I know of to apply for credit in the
right. Thank you.
Vision.
And I know we're bumping the legislative stuff, that I'm not sure, Jamie, how deep you plan to get on it. From reading these a few times, the entire engrossed House bills can be pretty hard to follow, and there's usually like a summary page. I don't know if we have those for some of these. It might make the discussion next month a little bit easier.
Good point.
I would encourage the members to bring their documentation back so that staff does not have to print all of this again.
I have a couple of things.
Eric, I'll type up a quick summary. What I was going to do is kind of just summarize the legislation. I provided the bill copies because there's some really technical things, especially I think Ryan and you as engineers may be interested in, but I will come with a more thorough summary.
Thank you.
April?
I'm gonna look at Mylar and see if any other jurisdictions in the state of Washington do not have to provide a copy. And I'm actually going to look into the other process improvements that were brought up.
Thank you. Okay, and then, when the email goes out for agenda items, Eric, I'll just wait to hear if you've gotten enough information to provide an update, and we can add that if we need to. Okay, we have 8 minutes left. Public comment. Is there anyone online that had anything they'd like to say or add? Okay, with that, meeting adjourned, and I'll see you all next month.